international news.
Today is Friday, November 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the presidential transition still in limbo.
It allows the president to fight, and at this point, he continues to do so.
An unprecedented move by the U.S. Secretary of State, also ahead, turning loneliness in the era of COVID into beautiful music. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump continues to refuse to publicly concede defeat in the November 3rd presidential election as Democrats press an administration official for an immediate briefing as to why she has not launched the transition process for President-elect Joe Biden. In a letter to General Services Administration head Emily Murphy, Democratic lawmakers said her refusal to begin transition activities required by law is having grave effects and hampering the incoming administration's ability to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, as well as endangering national security. Murphy has yet to certify Biden as the winner of the president's election, stalling the process of officially launching the transition. Joining us to discuss the legalities of all of it is Minneapolis-based attorney Jack Rice, who worked for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency during 9/11. Jack, President Trump has so far lost most of his legal challenges, but he has close to a dozen lawsuits still pending. Do any of these have any real potential to overturn the election?
It's unlikely at best. What we have seen from the court, specifically in Pennsylvania, is that you can make an allegation, but how do you then take one allegation or 10 allegations and say, so let's reject 650,000 votes? And that's something that we're seeing courts simply reject outright. So as a result, even if you look at the claims that are being made, they don't add up. The numbers simply don't add up. The president has the right to do it. And so technically, if you look at how the laws have been drafted, specifically when it comes to certification for each state, but also the Presidential Transition Act of 1963, it allows the president to fight. And at this point, he continues to do so.
And what about President-elect Joe Biden? What sorts of legal action does he have? So far, he hasn't taken any. And he said on Thursday that it's just something that would take up a lot of time. And he's continuing to work with his transition the best he can without any cooperation. But does he have any legal options at this point to get them to cooperate?
Not really. I mean, if we look at the dates, what we know is this, is that states are required to certify by December 8th. And so if we look at what happens once that's determined, is that the General Services Administration, again, a Republican who was appointed by the president who's making the call right now, then has to take those numbers and make a decision. But if you look at the way the law is drafted, it's not even clear what the policies are. So technically, the GSA could actually drag their feet and slow that process even further, which, by the way, makes it very, very difficult sometimes. Because ultimately, what you have here is you have a transition of one government to the next, and the shorter period of time that you have to do that, the more problems you can have in the short term and even long term.
That leads right to the bigger issue, perception here, but also abroad about democracy. The world looks at the U.S. for free and fair elections. That's at the heart of making this country a democracy. How much damage could it potentially do to perception of the U.S. around the world and also potentially make it more vulnerable?
So I think we look at it two ways. If you think about this idea of a clean transition from government to government over two plus centuries, the United States wanted to see themselves with a sort of an American exceptionalist, like that they can do this even when others can't. I think what this highlights is that other countries have struggled with this issue, and what we're finding is that the United States is struggling with it too. And so this has absolutely happened. Now, to your second question, though, could this be a problem for the U.S.? There was no question about it. You can go back to 2000. election and what happened between Vice President Gore and George Bush, the son. And you look at that problem. What we found even then, and they talked about this in the 9/11 investigations, that because of the failure of a clean transition, it slowed the ability of the U.S. government to respond to certain kinds of things, which made the U.S. more susceptible to a terrorist attack. So this is something we absolutely have, we've already looked at, and does it put us in that place again? Well, 2000 says it does.
Minneapolis-based attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice. More states are tightening their rules for gathering across the United States, with cases of coronavirus surging across the nation. They fear as people gather with family and friends for next week's Thanksgiving holiday, things could get even worse. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Thursday became the first senior U.S. official to visit a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. He also announced that from now on, goods made in Chinese settlements in the West Bank will be labeled Made in Israel. The visit is expected to be his last before President-elect Biden is inaugurated. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The State Department announced that products made in Jewish settlements can now be labeled Made in Israel, which is a change in U.S. policy. Until now, all settlement produce was labeled Made in the West Bank. The statement came as Pompeo visited the Psagot Winery in the settlement of Psagot near the Palestinian city of Ramallah. It was the first time a senior U.S. diplomat has visited a Jewish West Bank settlement. After the U.S. declaration a year ago that Jewish settlements are not illegal, the winery named a bottle after the Secretary of State. Several dozen Palestinians, like Abdul Jawad Saleh, a Palestinian-American citizen, protested against Pompeo's visit to the settlement. They say the West Bank, along with the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, must become a Palestinian state.
We tell the Americans, when you drink that wine, you are drinking the blood of the Palestinian people. And the smell you are, the aroma you have, it's the smell of the sweat of the Palestinian farmers.
Others said that President Trump is on the way out and they will continue fighting for their rights. This visit means nothing, she said. Trump is the person who took the side of settlers and settlements the most and declared that Jerusalem is the capital of this terrorist state. She said he is gone and the right will return to its owners no matter how many years it will take, as there is no occupation that lasted so long on this earth. Pompeo then continued to the Golan Heights, a territory that Israel captured from Syria in 1967 and later annexed. While most of the international community does not accept the annexation, President Trump again changed U.S. policy and recognized it as part of Israel.
Today I'll get a chance to visit the Golan Heights. The simple recognition of this as part of Israel, too, was a decision President Trump made that is historically important and simply a recognition of the reality.
Perhaps even more galling for Palestinians was Pompeo's statement regarding the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. He spoke at a joint news conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Today I want to make one announcement with respect to a decision by the State Department that we will regard the global anti-Israel BDS campaign as anti-Semitic. I know this sounds simple to you, Mr. Prime Minister. It seems like a statement of fact, but I want you to know that we will immediately take steps to identify organizations that engage in hateful BDS conduct and withdraw U.S. government support for such groups.
In a statement, the BDS movement said it rejects all forms of racism, including anti-Jewish racism, as a matter of principle. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Saudi Arabia had hoped hosting this week's summit of the G20 industrialized nations would be an opportunity to showcase the kingdom's social and economic changes and tout its position as a Middle East powerhouse. But analysts say the region and its oil and gas reserves may lose prominence in U.S. foreign policy as the future administration of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden focuses instead on renewable energy. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
OPEC kingpin, Saudi Arabia has enjoyed strong relations with the Trump administration, and some officials in the kingdom are wary of President-elect Joe Biden, the projected winner of the November 3 election against President Donald Trump, because Biden earlier promised to make the oil giant a pariah over its human rights failings. But Saudi Arabia's oil minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, says energy cooperation with the U.S. lays the basis for a good relationship for the common goal of maintaining oil market stability. We have a bilateral program. We have a joint aspiration of reducing emissions in the power sector, he told reporters earlier this week. If we can help each other bilaterally, it'll be a good launching pad for a good relationship with the yet-to-come Biden administration. Oilprice.com points to price wars initiated by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which drew Washington's wrath earlier this year. The online industry publication said Saudi moves attempted to destroy or at least disable the U.S. shale oil industry in March, that even President Donald Trump felt compelled to personally call the Crown Prince and tell him that if he did not end the oil price war, then the U.S. would withdraw its military support for Saudi Arabia. U.S. lawmakers said collapsing oil prices threatened to push American producers into bankruptcy. Michelle Dunn is the director of the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Middle East program. She told a panel this week that Biden knows a lot of these leaders and does not want to create a conflict with them. But U.S. policy decisions will take a more traditional set of U.S. national security interests into account.
President-elect Biden, like Trump and Obama before him, is going to see that the Middle East is becoming less important to the United States as the sunset of the oil era approaches. And this is the real nervousness of Middle East leaders.
Dunn also expressed concern the post-pandemic Middle East could witness more conflict.
There are many legacy issues and relationships the U.S. can't walk away from. But the Biden administration is going to have a lot of difficult decisions to make about how to slowly begin to lower the U.S. investment in this region without destabilizing it, without creating too many opportunities for regional or global rivals to take advantage of, without setting out off a new arms race in the region by arming our allies as we try to withdraw.
Analysts say a U.S. review of arms sales to Saudi Arabia following a massive arms deal with the United Arab Emirates may follow even as neighboring Iran seems bent on building up its nuclear program. Dil Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
A major Asian trade agreement known as RCEP, 9 years in the making, was just announced on Sunday without any input from the United States. Joining us to talk more about this and what it means for U.S.-China relations is David Feierstein, President and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Thank you so much for being with us. This was a long time in the making.
These trade agreements, these Pan-Asian trade agreements, such as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, take years and years to negotiate. But in this particular case, this is another example, and the latest example, of a Pan-Asian trade pact that has left the United States out because the United States wanted to be left out and chose not to be involved in this particular negotiation. The consequences of that, I think, are very serious for the United States in a variety of different ways. The pact itself is a partnership of 15 countries. 10 of them are the ASEAN countries, and the other five are among the most consequential economies in the world: China, Japan, South Korea, and also Australia and New Zealand. Together, these economies account for about 30% of the world's population and about 30% of global output. It's the single largest trading bloc in the world and in the history of the world. And we're not a part of it because this administration fundamentally took the view that these types of agreements are bad for America and that we're going to put, quote, America first and do things our way and to some extent maybe negotiate bilateral agreements. But philosophically, this administration simply doesn't buy into the notion of multilateral trade agreements, even those that, as RCEP does, lower tariffs and eliminate red tape, streamline trade in a variety of different ways. And from a geopolitical standpoint, the United States was not there in the process, did not get a chance to shape the outcome, not because we were excluded, but because the United States, under the Trump administration, very specifically and pointedly opted not to be involved. Now the question is, as we look forward to the Biden administration, what will the Biden administration do with reference to these kinds of agreements? And just in the last day or so, President-elect Biden noted that it's something that's on his radar and something that he's going to look at very carefully as president, and implying that this could be one of the areas where we may see a departure from Trump administration policy. So this is a momentous milestone in terms of Asian trade, and it's something that's going to figure and resonate with the United States and the global economy for years to come.
What happens with the U.S. and the tariffs that have been imposed by the Trump administration, and will the U.S. be able to participate at some point with this agreement?
It's a good question, and the issue of the Trump administration tariffs on, in particular, Chinese imports, but also on the imports of other countries, including allies and close trading partners. The WTO itself ruled these tariffs illegal under the rules of WTO that we as a nation subscribe to. So under the rules that we ourselves say that we accept as a nation, the Trump tariffs are illegal. And it makes it much more difficult for the United States to talk about accepted rules and norms in international trade when we ourselves have been deemed to have violated WTO rules in a very serious way. The notion of getting involved in RCEP or in what used to be referred to as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, now CPTPP, would be predicated on the United States lifting those tariffs and coming into compliance with the rules laid out in those types of agreements about tariffs. And just in the case of the one that was just signed a couple of days ago, the idea is to phase out and eliminate 90% of the tariffs that are there amongst the 15 partners of RCEP over a period of 20 years. Certainly where the United States is today would be in a tariff posture that is inconsistent with and incompatible with the notion of joining this agreement. But that said, one of the areas that Joe Biden as a candidate talked about in terms of differentiating himself from the Trump administration on trade and U.S.-China trade in particular is that Biden stated, and his vice presidential running mate Kamala Harris also stated, they will eliminate the Trump administration's tariffs on imported Chinese goods, not because it's good for China, but because eliminating those tariffs is good for America. So I think we're going to see some shifting in the way that the United States approaches trade with China specifically, but trade with Asia and with the world more generally. And I suspect this will be one of the areas where we see some fairly discernible departure in terms of policy from the outgoing Trump administration to the incoming Biden administration.
What are some of the confidence-building measures both countries can take to, you know, in the early days of the new administration to try to help restore the relationship?
Well, I think there are a number of things. Number one, I think having President Biden or a senior administration official after January 20th come out and give a major speech on China that resets the tone of the relationship and signals that this is going to be a new chapter in the U.S.-China relationship. That's one easy thing to do that's symbolic but important. Another is restore the two consulates. Get the U.S. consulate in Chengdu back up and running, get the Chinese consulate general in Houston back up and running, and get those diplomatic offices back in operational mode. A third thing is, I think, taking action on tariffs and, frankly, unilaterally eliminating the tariffs, because irrespective of what China does, eliminating the tariffs on incoming Chinese goods and services is actually good for America by every single economic metric that you can apply. You can send a signal as well that this is the beginning of a new chapter in the relationship.
David Firestein, President and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Thanks so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to Ndumbulo and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
VOA's International Edition continues. A nonprofit organization working to save the world's ocean life has compiled for the first time available data to uncover the impact that plastic is having on marine mammals and sea turtles in U.S. waters. Joining us now for more on the just released report is Dr. Kim Warner, author of the study and senior scientist with Oceana. Thank you for being with us. Tell us a bit about what this study uncovered.
For the very first time, we have compiled the first assessment of how many marine mammals and sea turtles in the U.S. have been impacted by plastic since the year 2009. And that's just about 1,800 cases that we have compiled. We got this data from government agencies and from marine life organizations, and the numbers are just astounding. 88% of the animals we found were threatened or endangered with extinction, and it's definitely a problem that we need to address right now.
When you say they're threatened with extinction, is it directly due to the impact of plastic in the ocean?
These animals have been deemed endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and they assess different threats to these animals when they're looking at recovery plans. And for sea turtles, we know that plastic is one of the threats that they list as a threat to their recovery for these endangered and threatened sea turtles. But there are many different stressors and threats that these animals face, like oil pollution and strikes and being entangled in fishing gear and caught in fishing gear and habitat destruction. So plastic is another stressor to these already vulnerable and threatened species.
This study was specifically looking at plastic, correct?
That is correct.
What did you find about the impacts of plastic to animals at all life stages?
So we found plastic affecting everything from baby sea turtles just recently hatched with their little beaks that they use to punch out of their shells, ingesting plastic within days of breathing air on their little journey to the ocean. And we found elephant seal mothers nursing their pups with their necks strangling with packing straps around their neck. We found Florida manatees, 700 cases of those, a lot of them eating recreational fishing line. Most of our cases are what animals swallowed, and very few were entanglements. So most of the sad cases had to do with what kinds of plastic these animals were eating. And that ranged from balloons and bags and candy wrappers all the way up to swim goggles and toothbrushes and all sorts of odd things we found described in the data.
And I would imagine that also impacted marine mammals like dolphins and whales?
Absolutely. On the West Coast, we saw a lot of entanglement with plastic packing straps. We also found there was a DVD case inside of a certain type of baleen whale on the East Coast that it had punctured her, lacerated her stomach, and contributed to her death. We found many cases of different types of plastic inside animal bellies, from northern fur seals and large whales to dolphins and eared seals, all kinds of different mammals.
What do you hope this report will do to potentially turn these numbers around?
Well, we know that the amount of plastic projected to be leaked into the ocean is projected to triple by 2040, that we really need to stop the amount of the production and use of needless single-use plastic to stem the tide of this problem. And the way we can do that is to pass strong policies at the local, state, and federal level to stop producing so much of this needless material that impacts these animals in such a sad and harmful way.
Will Oceana be looking to get this report and this information and promote policy changes on the local, state, and federal level?
Absolutely. We support all sorts of efforts that are moving away from needless single-use plastic, that are moving more towards refill and reuse models. We're working with organizers in states where we operate to help pass strong policies. And we are working at the national level, too, on the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act, which is a strong federal legislation that really helps to turn the tide on this problem.
Dr. Kim Warner, senior scientist with ocean protection organization, Oceana. Thanks for being with us. And finally today, for many, the COVID-19 pandemic has prompted fear, loneliness, and grief, along with a search for what it means to be connected with others. But for the Brooklyn-based piano virtuosa Simone Dinnerstein, the first months of quarantine with her husband and son meant a withdrawal even from music. Her road back was paved by the work of two very different composers, more than a century apart, but whose music seems connected. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dinnerstein about her odyssey and her new album, A Character of Quiet.
That's Simone Dinnerstein playing Etude No. 2 by Philip Glass, the contemporary American composer whose minimalist compositions are well known to classical music and film audiences alike. It's just one of the four pieces by Glass and the 19th century Austrian composer Franz Schubert that matched Dinnerstein's lonesome frame of mind during the pandemic's early days, when it seemed to her as if the world had stopped.
I felt that everybody on Earth was in a way alone at this moment because we couldn't interact with people in real life. You know, we have to use the internet. And it felt just very frightening, almost like being in a science fiction story.
Dinnerstein is a sought-after pianist beloved by global audiences for her solo and orchestral performances on the world's great stages. Before COVID-19, when she wasn't on stage or recording work like this Bach concerto, she was usually at home practicing or listening to music. But with COVID-19, all that changed.
I spent a lot of time going for walks in Greenwood Cemetery, which is a very, very beautiful old cemetery in Brooklyn, very close to where I live, and they were obviously actively burying people there. And it just felt like, in the face of all of that, I just didn't feel like making any music at all. And each day was completely unpredictable. Some days I just felt like just being in bed. I was so sad. And then other days I felt hopeful that this was going to end. And then sometimes during the day, those feelings would change.
Dinnerstein credits Adam Abeshouse, her friend and recording producer, with talking her back into music by encouraging her to record on her piano at home. When choosing just what to record during this strange time, she found the unpredictability of her moods mirrored by Franz Schubert and Philip Glass. She had once paired the two composers in concerts to highlight their uncanny similarities. Here's the rondo from the first movement of Schubert's Sonata in B-flat, whose initial theme is upbeat.
But then you'll have sudden just anguish and loud. And then it's like the sun comes out immediately after that, and you're just so tender. All of these emotional changes that happen in the music, they were really vivid to me.
Here's a taste of Philip Glass's Etude No. 16 with its own abrupt changes. Dinnerstein also says the unstructured quality of her days felt both circular and surreal.
You know, usually we have goals or deadlines or events that we're looking ahead to, and they were just gone. And so it felt a little bit like we were in a loop.
Dinnerstein also discovered subtly repeating, though subtly varying, musical patterns in both composers' work, as in Philip Glass's Etude No. 6. Dinnerstein says that being alone together with these great composers was a healing experience for her.
I'm definitely so much better now. Making that album was enormously restorative for me. I don't feel entirely like myself, but I'm much more there.
There is a certain bittersweetness for Dinnerstein when reflecting on the confusion and near despair of those early days. She misses all the unbroken alone time with her husband and son, for one, and the unearthly quiet in the city.
there was something magical about it. Suddenly, you know, having no traffic, hearing all of these birds that we just never ever heard. I really miss those birds now. So I guess I've taken from that, maybe it's not a good idea to be working every single minute. Like, maybe we need time not working or not being ourselves to find ourselves again.
That was piano virtuosa Simona Dinnerstein. Her album, A Character of Quiet, was released in September by Glass's label, Orange Mountain Music. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care, be well, and have a good weekend.